I'm just going to write a chapter about how skepticism was an inspiration to Indian philosophy. So it's nice to have that.
Nagarjuna and Charvakas.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm sure Alex needs no introduction, but I'm very, very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Alex Watson to the Centre for Hindu Studies. And this is a seminar in our series Texts and Interpretations, which we've had a few in the past, and this is a continuation of that series. Alex has done work on Shaiva Siddhanta, as you know, and he's just published a book on Ramakanta's critique of Buddhist... Oh, there we are. The self-awareness of itself, Bhattarama Kanta's arguments against the Buddhist doctrine of no self, with the very prestigious Dinobili series published in Vienna in 2006. And today he's going to talk to us about... I should also say he's working on a book on moksha, if I can say that. And he's working on a book with Dominic on Ramakanta's understanding of liberation. It's a translation of a text, I think, and a critical edition of it. And today he's going to speak to us on what did Ramakanta contribute to the Buddhist Brahmanical Atman debate. So, Alex, thanks for coming, and I'll hand it over to you.
Well, thank you, and thanks for asking me. Nice to be back in Oxford. And thanks for coming. I mean, you could be out snowboarding, building snowmen. The textual passages on which this is based are quite complicated, but I've tried to simplify without distorting them. But some parts will be quite complicated if you're not used to the ideas, so just ask me if you want me to repeat anything or explain anything more. I've got no problem with being interrupted. Well, the point is to show what Ramakanta adds to the Buddhist Brahmanical debate about the existence or non-existence of the self. And we'll see, hopefully, that he turns out to have a distinct voice in this debate, and that our knowledge of the debate is significantly enriched by observing what he has to say. So who was Ramakanta? He lived in Kashmir in the 10th century. And the tradition to which he belonged was Shaiva Siddhanta. Shaiva Siddhanta falls into two main periods. An early period in which it was a pan-Indian tradition from the 6th or 7th century, probably, until the 12th century. So that's the period in which Ramakanta falls. And Ramakanta is the principal exegete during that period. Principal both in terms of the number of texts he wrote and the influence he had on the later religion. And then this second later period from the 12th century onwards, when Shaiva Siddhanta survived only in the Tamil speaking south. And that Tamil Shaiva Siddhanta is much better studied than this earlier period. Ramakanta's philosophical texts on which this talk is based, none of them have been translated, and none of them are even really cited in secondary literature about Indian philosophy. Okay, well, before talking about what Ramakanta has to say, I'll spend the next 15 minutes or so just introducing the Buddhist Brahmanical Atman debate before Ramakanta's time. it was perhaps the Nayayikas and the Vaisheshikas who were the principal proponents of Buddhism prior to Ramakanta's time. Vedanta became more important later. So I'll use the position of the Nayayikas and Vaisheshikas to illustrate the Brahmanical side of this debate. And I'll give three ways in which the self was conceived of by Nayayikas and Vaisheshikas, and then in each case show how and why the Buddhists rejected the existence of such a thing. So first of all, Nayayikas and Vaisheshikas conceived of the self in terms of the distinction between substances and qualities. So an object such as a pot or a mango is a substance, and it has five qualities: taste, smell, colour, etc., corresponding to our five senses. The substance was regarded as a separate ontological entity from its qualities, as indicated by our use of language when we say the smell of the mango, implying that the mango is something that exists over and above its smell. As the parallel expression, the servant of the king, denotes two things. Nevertheless, a quality is inextricably linked to a substance. It cannot exist without one. We do not find a colour existing alone in midair. There must be some substantial object to which it belongs, some substrate, ashraya, that locates it. So the argument for the self that uses this distinction asserts that consciousness is a quality. Therefore, since all qualities are qualities of something, it requires a substance in which to inhere. Its substance cannot be the body, for that is insentient, so we can infer the existence of an immaterial self as the only possible possessor of consciousness. And we find examples of this argument in the Nyayavartika, Nyayamanjari, and Padartha Dharma Shastra, the first two Nyaya texts and the third one Vaisheshika. So how did the Buddhists respond to this? The Buddhists denied the existence of a self conceived of as the substance to which consciousness belongs. This was part of a more general denial of the existence of substances over and above qualities. In the case of the mango, the Buddhist points out that all we can experience there are five separate qualities. Through our eyes, we can see a visible form, rupa, consisting of a shape and colour. Through our faculty of taste, we can experience a taste, and so on. But we do not experience some further possessor of those qualities. None of our faculties apprehend such a thing. Neither could they in principle, given that our eyes can only sense form, our noses smells, etc. Thus for Buddhism, a mango is five things existing together in the same place, not one. The concept mango corresponds to no reality, but is a false unity that we superimpose onto something plural. It's like the concept of a forest, which our minds create and superimpose onto what is actually a plurality of trees. So these concepts for Buddhism were said to be pragyaktisat. They exist merely notionally. They don't correspond to anything in the external world. So the first diagram on your handout, on the right, under Buddhism, that's a diagram of a mango, according to Buddhism. Five things, five qualities, five small circles. And on the left, a mango according to Nyaya. Five qualities belonging to one unitary thing, mango. Well, for Buddhism, the case of the self is analogous. We experience instances of consciousness, perceptions, desires, thoughts, so we can grant reality to them. But we do not perceive some substrate of those instances of consciousness underpinning them, or some substance uniting them, in which they inhere. So Buddhism grants reality to consciousness, but not to some other thing to which consciousness belongs. The second way in which Nayayikas and Vaisheshikas conceived of the self was as an agent. That is to say, something which, by the impulse of its will or effort, prayatna, is capable of initiating action and bringing about effects. The self's agency is illustrated in the Vaisheshika Sutra and the Padartha Dharma Shastra by a sequence of comparisons. Just as a puppet requires a puppeteer to raise and lower its eyelids, so a body, being insentient, requires some agent, namely a self, to instigate such movement. Just as someone using bellows is required to direct air towards a fire, so a self is required to direct breath down into the lungs and up and out of the body. Just as a chariot requires a charioteer to steer it in particular directions, so the direction of our attention needs to be overseen by a self, which can shift our focus from, for example, what is currently accessible to our eyes to what is currently accessible to our ears. So the self was conceived of as a kind of controller or overseer, adhishtatri, responsible for the functioning of these processes like blinking and breathing. Yeah, I should make clear that this self of the Nayayikas and Vaisheshikas is not akin to a Vedantic absolute. It's not one thing that's manifest in all of us and in the world. It's for Nayayika and Vaisheshika, selves are distinct monads in each of us, and they stay separate from each other even in liberation. We never merge with each other. And these selves of the Nayayikas and Vaisheshikas, they're merely that which must be postulated to account for readily observable phenomena. They don't form the centre of, they don't have a sort of central place in the universe, as does the self of the Vedantins and the Samkhyas. They're merely one constituent of the universe alongside all the constituents of the external world. These selves of the Nayayikas, they're the agents of physical movements and also the agents of mental events. So the self of the Nayayikas and Vaisheshikas is both a kartri and a gyatri. Gyatri, my pronunciation sometimes confuses people, so whenever I say gyatri, that's what I'm talking about, or jnana, my pronunciation of that, jnana. They are the perceiver of our perceptions, the thinker of our thoughts. The perception of a pot, say, lasts just for an instant, but its perceiver outlives that perception and is the perceiver of the next and subsequent perceptions. So we have two things, the stream of consciousness and then the agent of that. What's Buddhism's response to this? And when I talk about Buddhism in this talk, I'm talking specifically of Dharmakirti, specifically of the philosophical tradition that began with Vasubandhu and his Abhidharma Kosha and Bhashya, was then further developed by his pupil Dignaga, who introduced elements of Yogacara, and was then further developed by Dharmakirti, who was in the same school as Dignaga. Not a direct pupil, but two generations down. So for Buddhism, there is no agent standing above the stream of psychophysical events like a puppeteer. If this line represents a movement, a bodily movement, the agent of that movement is simply the act of will in the previous moment that brings it about. And if subsequently, further down the line in this particular stream, there's another movement of a different bodily part, the agent of that movement is not the same as the agent of this movement. It's rather the act of will in the immediately, in the moment which precedes it. So there's a plurality of agents, according to Buddhism. If these now represent mental events, mental actions, as opposed to physical actions, so let's say this is consciousness of a pot, followed by consciousness of a cloth, consciousness preceding a cloth. Well, the agent in the sense of the perceiver of this perception of a pot is simply the perception itself. The agent of that perception is simply consciousness at that moment. That which is conscious of the pot is consciousness at that particular moment. We don't need to postulate any other subject of consciousness apart from consciousness itself. So to put that into Sanskrit, for Buddhism, the grahaka, the thing which grasps, the perceiver, is simply jnana, is simply that moment of consciousness. Or to put it another way, for Buddhism, there's no difference between the gyatri and the jnana. These are the same thing. So when we say, I see a pot, I refers to the instance of consciousness that perceives the pot. But when we say, I see a cloth, in the next moment, I refers to something different. It refers to this next moment of consciousness, which perceives the cloth. So the subject of all our mental actions is different. There's no common subject of any of them. So to sum up this section on the self as agent, there's a duality in the meaning of the word agent. It can either mean that which brings about the action, and for the Buddhist that is just that which causes it, i.e. the previous moment of consciousness, which is itself caused by the previous moment of consciousness, etc. So the Buddhist replaces talk of agents with talk of causes, and all causes for Buddhism fall within a chain of causation, and so are themselves conditioned. And the other sense of agent is that which does the action, that which does the perceiving. And here Buddhism denies that we have two simultaneously existing things, the action and something else that does it. For Buddhism, an action is simply an event that occurs in a particular psychophysical stream. And thirdly, the self was conceived of by the Nyayikas and Vaisheshikas as our essence, what we really are, something separate from our body and our senses, and existing on a deeper, more enduring level than them. They, by comparison, are incidental, not essential to our identity. And the self, in this sense, is that part of us that doesn't change over time. That which means we continue to be the same thing when we have a different body in a different incarnation, or no body in between incarnations. So if this is our body in this life, and then there's a period of time when we're not embodied at all between lives, and then this is our body in our next life, the self is what explains why it's us throughout this whole period, because the self continues to exist unchanged throughout our various lives, despite our bodies ceasing to exist and being replaced by new ones. Well, for Buddhism, we have no essence. We're not one thing. We're actually an ever-changing configuration of five things, five skandhas. A body and four mental constituents. There is, for Buddhism, of course, a part of us that is separate from the body and the senses, and that can reincarnate. Only the Charvakas denied that. But it is not a self, it's consciousness. And it's plural, it's something different in each moment. each moment of consciousness is linked to the next, in that it causes it to arise. The situation at death is similar to that during life. The last moment of consciousness during life gives rise to a new consciousness in the first moment after death. But whereas during life, each moment of consciousness was associated with a momentary configuration of a body, at death, consciousness can separate from the bodily constituent and can reproduce itself sequentially until such a time as it becomes associated with a new body, a new embryo in the womb of its next mother. So that's death, and that's the next birth. On the handout, the reason the diagram's a bit more complicated is of the five skandhas of Buddhism, four of them continue after the death of the body, and it's just the rupa, it's just the fifth skandha, the body, which, the corpse. In this diagram, these are the last two moments of the body before death. Then in the first moment after death, the corpse continues lying on the ground, and consciousness separates and goes off, and these are the first two moments in a new embryo. But this is a bit simplified. In this diagram, consciousness stands for the four mental skandhas, four mental constituents of human beings according to Buddhism. So Buddhists do, of course, use I for purposes of everyday communication. But on analysis, when we consider what this I refers to, we find that it dissolves into a plurality, both synchronically and diachronically. So across time, we have not one thing, but a plurality of moments. And even in one moment, we have not one thing, but five things. So this Buddhist position that emphasises that we're not unitary, we're plural, we're not permanent, we're temporary, and that it also emphasises the kind of non-personal nature of these psychophysical streams that we're held to consist of. We're regarded by Buddhism as a stream of events, a stream of impersonal events. Okay, so that's the introduction about the debate between Nyaya and Buddhism. What is Ramakanta's position in all this? Well, Ramakanta is convinced by the Buddhist arguments that in the case of the mango or such like, we don't perceive a substance lurking behind the qualities that present themselves to our senses, and by the general point that there is no dharmin over and above dharmas, no property possessor dharmin over and above properties, dharma. Both Buddhism and Ramakanta agree that such a thing is a kind of metaphysical extravagance that results from multiplying entities, from departing from what we can experience, going beyond the evidence of our mind and senses. Thus he agrees that there is no self-substrate over and above consciousness. He also agrees with Buddhism that there is no self as agent of consciousness over and above consciousness. The perceiver of our perceptions, the thinker of our thoughts, is just consciousness at that particular moment. How then does he preserve the self? For Ramakanta, consciousness is the self. He equates the self and consciousness. Or to put it another way, consciousness is the nature, the swabhava of the self. In Indian philosophy, the relation of a thing and its nature was one of identity, tadatmya. Sameness. A thing and its nature are the same thing. So to be the nature of a thing is very different from being a quality or a property of it, a guna or a dharma, because as we saw, the model there was of two things, a thing and its property or its quality, properties or quality. So Ramakanta has a difficult task. He has to show that consciousness is permanent, not something fleeting, as held by both Buddhism and the Nyayikas and Vaisheshikas. For the Nyayikas and the Vaisheshikas also, consciousness consists of discrete events. These discrete events belong to a permanent self, but they themselves are momentary, as for the Buddhists. So for the Nyayikas, there is a self, and it's separate from the stream of consciousness. For Buddhism, there is no self, there's just the stream of consciousness. For Ramakanta, there is a self, but it's just consciousness. So Ramakanta travels down the path of Buddhist argumentation quite a long way. He reduces the self to the stream of consciousness, but then he argues that the stream is unchanging. So to put that into diagrammatic form, it's as though Ramakanta crosses out this long line of the Nyayikas, says there's no such thing as that, but all we have is consciousness. But then he joins up this dotted line and claims that consciousness is something stable and unchanging, not something momentary. So between Buddhism and the Brahmanical schools, it was a debate about the existence or non-existence of an entity, this self over and above consciousness. Between Buddhism and Ramakanta, which we'll focus on for the rest of the talk, there's agreement about what exists. It's just a question of how to classify that, whether something changing or unchanging. So how can we decide this matter? Well, Ramakanta suggests that it should be our direct experience of ourselves, i.e. consciousness as experience of itself, that should be our guide. We should go straight to that and cease philosophical debates or inferences for the time being, in which the presuppositions of the tradition to which we belong will play a part. Consciousness's direct experience of itself is the same whichever philosophical tradition one belongs to. That point is made on page 2 of your handout. Halfway down you'll see NPP add 1.5, and the first sentence underneath that, Nahi pratidarshanam vyavastapaka naam sarva paramatru naam anubhava vedaha sambhavati. Consciousness's direct experience itself is the same, according to Ramakanta, whether one is a pundit or a child. That's the half verse that's indented just underneath that sentence I read. Jnanam pratyabhilapam cha sadrishau bala panditau. So we'll carry on reading this passage for a bit. We won't actually read much of this handout, but I'll read just a couple of sentences. So underneath that quoted verse, which is from the Vakyapadiya, tat sat evayam sakala loka prasiddha swanubhavo nirupyatam. Therefore tat sat evayam swanubhavaha, this very self-experience, which is sakala loka prasiddha, which is well known to the whole world, something we all experience, nirupyatam, should be examined. Well, when focusing on our self-experience, what's the precise question we need to ask? He now articulates that. Kim pratyartam pratichandam cha apurvaha apurvaha purvotarabhyam anubhavabhyam binnaha shanamatra rupa avabhasu grahakaha prakashate putta sarvadaiva binna iti. Is it the case, Kim, that the perceiver, grahaka, and remember that for both Buddhism and Ramakanta the perceiver is just consciousness, is it the case that the perceiver shines forth, prakashate, i.e. appears to us, as apurvaha, apurvaha, as constantly new, pratyartam, pratichandam cha, with regard to every object and in every moment? Do we sense that we're a different perceiver every time we perceive a different object? and in every moment? Does the perceiver part of us appear to us as Binnaha, different, Purvottarabhyam, from the previous and subsequent Anubhavabhyam experiences? Shandamatra Rupa Bhavasu, appearing merely momentarily? Or, Uta, does the perceiver appear as Sarvadaivabhinna, as permanently undivided? If it appears as permanently undivided, then Ramakanta's right. If it appears in the first way, then Buddhism's right. Simple as that. So that's the question. Now we have Ramakanta's answer, which is intended to be just a description of the way consciousness appears to us. Tatra, I am Stirarupaha Prakashaha, Sarvadaiva. Tatra, with regard to that question, this Prakasha, literally this light, this illumination, but here being used as a synonym of consciousness, this consciousness, and then we have to read down to the end, you know, to quite a few lines below, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines below that, towards the end of the line you'll see Pratipurusham Swasamvedana Siddha. So that's the predicate here. This Prakasha is Swasamvedana Siddha, established through self-awareness, Pratipurusham, in every person, to be, and then we go back to the beginning of the sentence, Stirarupa and Sarvadaiva. This Prakasha is established by self-awareness in every single person to be stable, Stirarupa, and permanent, Sarvadaiva. And it is Grahyapadi Bedepi Anaswadita Svatma Bedaha. Anaswadita Svatma Bedaha is an instrumental Bahuvrihi. So consciousness is something by which a different Veda of its own nature, Svatma, is Anaswadita, is not tasted, not sensed. So consciousness does not sense any break in its own nature. We don't sense any discontinuity in our existence. Even though there is a difference, Vedepi, of Grahyopadi, of secondary delimiting factors, namely objects, Grahyas. So objects differ, objects change as we experience the world around us, but the perceiver does not. Our consciousness of the perceiver part of us is unbroken, unchanging. This word upadi, secondary delimiting factor, the meaning is that these objects, they delimit consciousness to some extent. We'll say, okay, this is a consciousness, now I'm having consciousness of a pot, now I'm having consciousness of a cloth, but they delimit it only secondarily, they don't really affect its nature. It's like when you put a red object behind a crystal and you look at the crystal, you might think, oh, now the crystal's turned red, but actually the nature of the crystal hasn't been affected at all. You see it as red, but that's just because there's an upadi in the form of this red object that's been put behind it. So similarly with objects and consciousness, when consciousness perceives different objects, its nature isn't actually affected by them, only secondarily. Kala Triyapi Tiraskruta Swagata Praga Bhava Pragamsa Bhava. Even in all three times, so in the past, present and future, consciousness is never aware of having Praga Bhava or Pragamsa Bhava. It's never aware of not having existed in the previous moment or ceasing to exist in the next moment. And yet, if our self-awareness were momentary, we would feel constantly new, as though what we were in the last moment had just ceased to exist. Nana vidha pramanadi aneka chitta vritti udaya vyaya samvedanepi akampita tadgrahaka starya vedana. Even though, Api, we are aware, or consciousness is aware, samvedane, of the rise and fall, Udaya Vyaya, of various chittavrittis, aneka chittavritti, even though we are aware that various thoughts come and go, the rest of that compound is not important. Akampita tadgrahaka starya vedana. So even though we experience thoughts to come and go, our experience, vedana, of the stability, starya, of the perceiver of those thoughts, tadgrahaka, is akampita, unshaken. So we experience thoughts as coming and going. We never experience the perceiver of those thoughts as coming and going. Two different kinds of words. We have words like perceiver, which refer to the subject of mental actions or mental states. And we have words like perception or consciousness, which refer to the mental state or the mental action. And for Nyayikas or for common sense philosophers, these two kinds of words refer to two different kinds of things, both of which exist. There's a perceiver, there's something doing the perceiving, and then there's the perception itself. There's the subject of consciousness, and there's consciousness. There's the cognizer, and there's cognition. There's the thinker, and there's the thought. But for both Ramakanta and Buddhism, they claim that these two kinds of words actually refer only to one thing. We're talking about one thing, not two. But the conflation of these two entities takes place in a different direction, as it were, in the case of Ramakanta and in the case of Buddhism. For Ramakanta, the concept of consciousness dissolves into the perceiver and will cross out consciousness. For Buddhism, the concept of the perceiver dissolves into Buddhism. At least this is my way of...
Into consciousness.
Yeah, what did I say?
Buddhism.
into consciousness, yeah. I must have been looking at that, yeah. So the perceiver dissolves into consciousness and we cross out this. So in both cases, for Buddhism and Ramakanta, we're left with just one entity. But the entity that Ramakanta is left with, even though it is both a perceiver and its consciousness, it retains more of the characteristics that we would associate with a perceiver, or that Nyayikas, for example, would associate with a perceiver, i.e. it's unchanging. Whereas the entity that Buddhism is left with, even though Buddhism also conflates the two and claims that this thing is both consciousness and a perceiver, retains more of the characteristics that we would associate with consciousness, or that a Nyayika would associate with consciousness. So that's why this entity ends up being unchanging here and changing here. And you can see that in this sentence, the way that in this sentence we've just read, Ramakanta says, well, we experience thoughts as coming and going, but we never experience the perceiver of those thoughts as coming and going. So Ramakanta is seeing consciousness very much as the perceiver, and that's what lends plausibility to his view that consciousness is not changing. Whereas for Buddhism, this chittavritti that's mentioned here, well, that would be an example of consciousness, and this rise and fall of chittavrittis would be used by Buddhism to support their view that the consciousness is changing. Okay, Vritti Yantaraleshu Api Avilupta Jyotihi. The subject is still Prakasha from earlier in the sentence. Consciousness is something whose radiant jyoti is uninterrupted, avilupta, even between the thoughts, kriti antaraleshu. So when we go for a period of time when we're not thinking, in between the thoughts, it's not as though then when we start thinking again, suddenly we think, oh, I've just started to exist all over again. We have a sort of unbroken sense of some kind of self-consciousness even between our thoughts. Sushuptadavapi akandita swasambit. Consciousness is awareness of itself, is unbroken even in deep sleep. Slightly more controversial maybe, but there are considerations that imply that even in deep sleep we have some kind of self-awareness. Okay, and then we'll skip to iti kim atra anyena sadhanena, the end of that sentence. So what is the need of other means of proving it? And that's the last of the Sanskrit we'll actually read. I'll just summarise the rest of it. What is the need of other means of proving it? Of proving this unbroken consciousness, this unchanging consciousness? Why do I need further argument or inference when I'm not asserting the existence of anything more than that? No invisible metaphysical entity, no substance, simply an uninterrupted process of the shining forth of perceiving light. Something which we all experience. It's on the basis of this very unbroken self-awareness that we undertake action that will produce fruits in the future. If our self-awareness were momentary, no one would ever act, because we would see other phases of our consciousness as not me and not belonging to me, na aham, na mama. So why act on their behalf? That might seem like a slightly trite remark, but I don't think it's inappropriate of Ramakanta to make that argument at this point, because the Buddhist is here claiming that our consciousness not only is momentary, but appears to us as momentary, with each moment being distinct. We have the nasha and utpati between each moment of consciousness, according to Buddhism. This moment of consciousness ceases to exist completely, and this moment of consciousness comes into existence without having existed before. So there's a For Buddhism, there is a definite break between these moments of consciousness. So it seems fair of Ramakanta to hold that if that was the case, we should feel more alienation from other phases of our stream than we do. So to summarise that passage, this passage we've been looking at, if we focus on our own self-experience, that tells us that we are the same person over time. Consciousness is the same thing over time. The objects we experience are different from each other. We don't sense that they are perceived by different consciousnesses. It feels like the same me experiencing all of them. We experience the rise and fall of many thoughts, but we have a sense of the sameness of the perceiver of those thoughts. Our undertaking of action, whose fruits will accrue in the future, is predicated on that sense of uninterrupted personal continuity. Okay, at this point, the Buddhist shifts his ground slightly, or at least clarifies his position, and says, okay, the perceiver does appear to me as stable, the perceiver part of me does appear to me as stable, but that appearance of stability, and when I say stable I mean non-momentary, I mean continuously existing, that stable appearance is not trustworthy, because it results from us superimposing stability onto something that's actually momentary. So according to the Buddhist, what we really experience is consciousness flashing on and off in every moment. What we really experience is that we're a different perceiver in every single moment. But we mistake that for one continuous, unbroken thing. It's like looking at a calm stream. We think we're looking at one unchanging block of water, but in fact lots of bits of water are rushing by. We're deceived. So this example shows how there can be a distinction between what we're actually looking at and what we think we're looking at. And it's the same with consciousness, with a succession of distinct momentary perceivers. Each one resembles the previous one so closely and succeeds it so rapidly that we're fooled into mistaking a plurality for a unity. We superimpose stability onto what's momentary. So the Buddhist here agrees that, okay, we do appear to ourselves as continuous, stable, as the same thing over time. And it does seem realistic that the Buddhist would respond like that, because if we didn't appear to ourselves in that way, there would be no need for a Buddhist path. There would be no mistaken view that we are a self, Satkaya Drishti, as it's called in Buddhist texts, which needs correcting. For the Buddhist, this experience of ourselves as stable occurs, but it's mistaken. It's just a symptom of our attachment, our clinging to ourselves. Indeed, it's the purpose of Buddhist meditation, at least one kind of it, to correct this mistake, to root out from our experience of ourselves the notions of I and self. Excuse me a second. So we've now reached the crux of the matter, the precise point that separates Ramakanta and Buddhism. We saw previously how they both accept that there is no self over and above consciousness, how all that separated them was whether consciousness is changing or unchanging. Now we can see that they both agree that consciousness appears to itself as stable. The controversial point is thus whether this stable appearance is the way that consciousness appears to us directly, or whether it results from us superimposing stability onto it. So for Ramakanta, this experience of ourselves as stable, which Buddhism admits, is consciousness directly experiencing itself. But for Buddhism, we mistakenly think that we're experiencing one stable and continuous thing. So now that this is the focus of the discussion, is determining whether this experience is a direct experience of consciousness, or is us, results from us superimposing stability onto consciousness. And I'll give three ways in which Ramakanta attacks this Buddhist idea that we superimpose stability onto ourselves. One, the notion of superimposing stability onto oneself is incoherent. There's no problem with the idea that a river or a succession of momentary things could fool something other than them into mistaking them for one thing. But what the Buddhist is asking us to believe is that consciousness is fooling itself, that we are fooling ourselves. It's as though in the example a river or a succession of momentary entities were deceiving not an observer but themselves. Two, for Buddhism, that which appears to us as stable is superimposed by something momentary. But how could something momentary be capable of superimposition? To carry out superimposition requires more than one moment. We have to see the object of the present moment, then recall previous moments, spot the similarity of the present moment with them, and then join them into one thing through the superimposition of stability. Not enough time for one moment to do that. The example that the Buddhist often gives of this kind of superimposition of unity is of someone swinging a firebrand at night, and we see it as one continuous circle, when in fact what's happening is the firebrand is here at one point in time, here at another point in time, here at another point in time, but we see it as one continuous circle. But it's clear from that example that we wouldn't see it as one continuous circle unless we existed for long enough for the firebrand to do a complete revolution. So how could something momentary superimpose this stability? Thirdly, the standard example of superimposition, which the Buddhists also use, was of superimposing silver onto mother of pearl. We see some mother of pearl and we mistake it for silver. But it's quite clear there that we must have experienced silver on a previous occasion in order to acquire the concept and superimpose it onto some mother of pearl. But in a Buddhist universe, where everything, both perceivers and objects of perception, are momentary, where could we ever have perceived something stable and enduring? In order to acquire that concept of stability and to impose it on things which are momentary. Okay, there's not much more to go, but for the rest of the talk, I'm just going to pick out four more points from disparate places in Ramakanta's text in order to further clarify his position. At one point, the Buddhist asks, how can consciousness be permanent when to be conscious of something is an action? This comes out perhaps more strongly in the Sanskrit than the English. The words that I'm translating as consciousness here are things like dhyana, samvit, prakasha, vijnana. And this is much more clearly an action noun than consciousness, because when we say I perceive a pot in Sanskrit, that would be gatam aham janami. So jnana is a nominal form of this verb, janami, janati. Whereas in English we don't say I conscious a pot. So anyway, the point of this Buddhist objection is, how can you say consciousness is permanent when consciousness is an action? We're conscious of something, and then we're conscious of something else. And these are separate actions. An action is transitory. It has a beginning and an end. Ramakanta's response is, there is one example of a permanent action, namely illumination, or shining. The sun shines uninterruptedly and permanently. Similarly, the self shines forth constantly in the form of the light of consciousness. So this analogy of the sun's action of illumination is intended to show how consciousness can be dynamic. It's something that's happening, but it's something which is constant and therefore unchanging and unaffected by the things that it does illuminate. Second point. Ramakanta's view is that as consciousness of a pot is followed by consciousness of a cloth, as we change from perceiving a pot to perceiving a cloth, consciousness itself does not change, only the objects change. So another diagram. Consciousness shining forth like the sun, and various objects of various different shapes and sizes pass in front of it, and consciousness illuminates those objects. We thereby become aware of these objects. But for Ramakanta, consciousness itself never changes. All that changes are the objects that pass in front of it. Well, the Buddhist opponent claims that consciousness should be coloured by its object. These objects, the form of these objects, should somehow enter into consciousness and therefore differentiate consciousness. Because otherwise, how could consciousness register their presence if it's completely unaffected by them? How could consciousness register the presence of these objects? Objects, according to Buddhism, should put their stamp on consciousness, because the very way in which consciousness perceives an object is by taking the form of that object. That's Dharmakirti's Satrantika point of view. Well, Ramakanta does not see why that should be so. For, to return to the analogy of light that the Buddhists also use to elucidate the nature of consciousness, When a light illuminates an object, we do not regard that object as affecting the light, colouring it, or causing it to be turned on. To illustrate this point, another diagram occurred to me. So I gave two columns here, one for agent words, one for the mental action, the mental state. We could add in a third one. I haven't left much room, but it can't go here, actually it has to go here. This third column is objects of consciousness, objects of perception. Well, for Buddhism, consciousness contains within itself an image of the object. That's just a circle with a line down the middle. And this image of the object, which is contained within consciousness, is what we directly experience. As we experience the world around us, according to Buddhism, we're experiencing images which are internal to consciousness. We have no access to any objects external to consciousness. And for the Dharmakirti sometimes writes from a Sautrantika point of view and sometimes from a Yogacara point of view. The Sautrantika position is that even though all we directly experience are these images within consciousness, we can infer the existence of an external object as that which causes the image. But the Yogacaras didn't think we needed to make that inference, because they thought once there's the admission that all we can experience directly are these images within consciousness, well then an external object provides no better explanation of those images than other explanations, such as samskaras, traces, vasanas, as we experience in dreams, for example, where there's no external object. So I'll put a dotted line through the object to show that some Buddhists delete it altogether, and others say we can infer existence. Anyway, the point I'm making is that for Buddhism, consciousness includes within itself both perceiver and perceived. Has two poles to it, consciousness for Buddhism. Perceiver pole and the perceived image. So, whereas for Ramakanta, this external object certainly is existing, and it's completely separate from consciousness, which is also the perceiver. So this diagram represents two different ontologies for Ramakanta and Buddhism. Buddhism, there's one thing consisting of both perceiver and perceived. So of course consciousness, when conceived of like this, is something changing, because there's no question that what we perceive changes. So if consciousness consists partly of what we perceive, then of course consciousness changes. But for Ramakanta, the grahya, the object of perception, exists outside consciousness. So consciousness is therefore freed from influence from the object. Consciousness for Ramakanta doesn't have to be differentiated by its objects, because it's ontologically distinct from its objects. It's a kind of pure light that does not bear the stamp of its object. What for the Buddhist is one thing, this consciousness including both perceiver and perceived, is two for Ramakanta. So Ramakanta can separate off the perceiver as unchanging and claim that all that changes as our mental life unfolds are objects of consciousness. Well, how about where there is no external object that changes, but there seems to be a change of consciousness? Isn't that problematic for Ramakanta? So, for example, we feel pain in one moment, we feel pleasure in the next, but there's no change of external object. Well, for Ramakanta, pleasure and pain are actually objects in relation to perceiving consciousness. This perceiving consciousness looks onto them unaffected, and pleasure and pain are objects of consciousness. That's a Samkhya position. And there was an older debate between Samkhya and Buddhism on precisely that point, of whether pleasure and pain are objects of consciousness, which Samkhya claimed, or whether they're forms of consciousness, or the precise terms, chaitas in Buddhist Abhidharma, pleasure and pain are chaitas, they're factors associated with consciousness. So again, we see Ramakanta dividing what is one thing for the Buddhist into two. For the Buddhist, pleasure or pain is consciousness in a certain form. Ramakanta says no, pleasure or pain is a result of two things. It's a result of an unchanging perceiver experiencing pain or pleasure as an object. And the final point, consider the situation. At one point in time, when consciousness is perceiving a multicoloured object, well, Buddhism admits in that case that we have one unitary consciousness perceiving a plurality of objects, a plurality of different colours. So Ramakanta asks, well, if you're prepared to accept that in one moment one thing can perceive a plurality of objects, why don't you accept that across time we can have one temporally extended consciousness perceiving a plurality of different objects? Why do you Buddhists treat this case of a plurality of objects being perceived simultaneously different from the case of a plurality of objects being perceived sequentially? And there's a long discussion in a very nice passage where Ramakanta is very original, and where he puts forward this argument that I think is very strong, showing that the Buddhist is inconsistent in that the Buddhist treats a temporal sequence very differently from a spatial sequence and has no grounds for doing so. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you. Have a kind of monad consciousness, or is he working toward a kind of Vedantic singular consciousness?
No, he's not working towards a Vedantic singular consciousness. For Ramakanta too, just like for the Nayayikas and Vaisheshikas, souls are distinct monads. And we remain separate from each other even in liberation. I think that's probably a fairly standard position for the theistic schools, no? Can you think of any theistic school that held selves to dissolve at liberation into a greater whole?
Not really.
Unless that greater whole was in some sense itself relational. See what I mean? You can become part of a larger whole, which is in a sense a unit. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's a quick question.
But no, it wasn't a dumb question.
I've got lots of questions. I have to go back to my notes. I'm just curious about the philosophy. Some which is very good, and some of it's a bit wacky. I'm interested where he says that we don't perceive ourselves to change from moment to moment. Therefore, intuitively, it seems quite strong that we continue. Isn't that exactly what the Buddhists were trying to deal with when they came up with various strategies by which they explained that sort of causality continued quite strongly from moment to moment, and allowed us to have a kind of continuity of memory, a continuity of awareness. That, I mean, things like later the sort of the idea of a storehouse consciousness, which various strategies for saying yes, there are structures, there are memories, there is a transmission, though it's not substantial, it's structural or it's causal or something like that, and that accounts quite happily and quite adequately for our whole sense of self continuity. I mean, is anything that Ramakanta says dealing with that?
Yeah, well, the storehouse consciousness of the Yogacaras, that doesn't form a part of Dharmakirti's system, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And Dharmakirti thinks he can account for continuity without even that. Yeah, from Dharmakirti's point of view, he can account for our sense of for memory and for our sense of continued personal identity on this picture of only having these distinct moments with absolutely nothing to which they belong or absolutely nothing continuing to exist beyond that moment. He doesn't think you need any more than that, because he thinks that each of these moments will contain within it memory traces,
yeah,
samskaras and vasanas, and it will cause the next moment to arise containing the same or very similar memory traces to what it contains.
Yeah, exactly. But then I don't see that Ramakanta's dealt with that, other than saying it doesn't seem that way to me much, mate, in a sense. If you see what I mean, he's not really engaged. He hasn't disproved, really, that. Because in theory that would account for what Ramakanta's saying.
Yes, you're right. Perhaps that would... perhaps that would be able to get around some of Ramakanta's objections. I mean, if we think of the three objections that Ramakanta comes up with,
mm-hmm,
I don't think that would help the Buddhist get around the first objection about...
can the stream perceive itself?
Yeah, the Buddhist is asking us to believe that... that consciousness is deceiving itself. It's not deceiving something separate.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, because that's right. With the silver, the Buddhist can say, oh yeah, we've got a silver memory that's been passed on.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Similarly with the firebrand. But that's right. Although Niva's made a very good argument about whether or not the self can fool itself, it seems to me. I mean, the whole premise of the Buddhist argument is that that's exactly what happens. There's no reason why the self should necessarily have a clear perception of itself. I mean, I think it's just not shown either way. You're right, that one's of a different order, though. It's a different kind of projection.
I was expecting that giving the talk in the Hindu Studies Centre, there'd be more sympathy for the Hindu side.
Well, that's just for you.
No, I think you make a good point. I think... Ramakanta's arguments about the impossibility of one moment being able to superimpose, the Buddhists could get around that by saying, well, each moment contains within itself traces of all the past experience. So in the case of seeing the firebrand as one continuous circle, okay, well, you perceive the first point of the circle there, the next point of the circle there, next point of the circle there, next point of the circle there. But all of those past experiences are passed on from moment to moment. So by the time you get to the end, even though it's only one moment of consciousness perceiving the last point of the circle, since it has in the form of memory traces the rest of the circle,
yeah,
then
it contains the previous moments in a sense.
Yes. So in that case, you could say, well, why does it matter which view you take, Ramakanta or the Buddhist? But it is really crucial, because it's the difference between Buddhism claiming that we're not one thing, these really are distinct from each other.
Mm.
So that's really offensive to the Hindu schools, because it means that, for example, the thing that performed an action is not the same thing which gets the karma, which reaps the rewards for it. So you can spend all this money doing your Jyotishtoma ritual and it's not you who gets the reward.
Yes, yes.
If you kill somebody, someone else gets punished for that. What was the third objection? There was the not being able to fool yourself. There was one moment requiring not being able to do super...
Silver and makeup, isn't it?
Yes, that in that case of... In that example, it's clear that you must have experienced silver previously in order to mistake something for silver that isn't silver. So, in order to mistake something for a unitary, temporally extended thing, you must have experienced a temporally extended thing in the past.
The strongest one is the superimposition one, I would have thought, the second one, which... I can't see how the Buddhist model can account for that, actually.
The five
bindings.
Yeah, well, the superimposition, the point there was that in order to carry out superimposition, you have to do various things. You have to... If you imagine this as... a river, as bits of water that count. It's a bit hard to know how to represent that visually, but if you imagine these as different bits of water which are rushing by, but we're fooled because each one of these is so similar to the previous one, and it's succeeding it so rapidly, we don't notice that there's lots of things rushing by. We think there's only one thing.
Right.
So that's a case where we can, where superimposition seems plausible. But for that to take place, this is Ramakanta's point, one single moment wouldn't be able to... I mean, you have to observe, you know, you have to exist for long enough to...
Yeah, you have to have a superimposer in a sense.
Yeah, a superimposer that exists for the whole length of these momentary entities onto which it's going to superimpose reality. I suppose what the Buddhist would say is, okay, even though there's one momentary perceiver perceiving this bit of water, then a different momentary perceiver perceiving this bit of water, then a different momentary perceiver this bit, different moments. Even though for Buddhism there's different perceivers, still each one passes on traces of the experience it's had to the next moment. So the experience, so I could see how the Buddhist could explain that, but the experience of the previous bits of water rushing by, I mean, this momentary perceiver could remember the two previous moments. That could, this moment could be about memory. That could be about remembering the previous moment. This next moment could be about spotting the similarity between these moments, or this moment and past ones. And then the next moment could be about superimposing stability onto that.
So each moment must contain the totality of all the moments that have gone before.
Yeah, not necessarily the totality, because when we reach old age, we forget some
things.
So some memory traces die out.
Right.
It's the thing of the billiard ball, isn't it? That it knocks the next one, and certain things, the direction and the speed or whatever, will get passed on even though there's no connection between them. And it's got some memory.
Yes, so the plausibility of this Buddhist picture does rely on memory traces being able to be passed from one thing to another. And that's another point where you could attack Buddhism, that this language of memory traces being passed, that implies one continuously existing thing being passed.
They'd argue not, isn't it? I mean,
well, they would say okay, this ceases to exist, but it causes this one to arise, containing the same memory traces as itself. But that's maybe asking quite a lot to believe. I mean, there's two problems with that. One is, how does it cause it to arrive? Where does this new moment come from? How does it come to exist out of nothing? Because there's no material cause. For the Brahmanical schools, you have the substrate, the self is the substrate, that's always there, that's continually existing. But at this point, when that ceases to exist, there's nothing else existing. So how does this one suddenly come into being?
How does Dharma Kirti account for that?
I don't know. I think what Dharma Kirti would say is, okay, he doesn't... he doesn't maybe intend to reify these moments to quite that extent. What he's doing is he's taking what the Brahmanical schools held to be one unchanging static entity,
yeah.
and Dharmakirti's saying it's a process that's
yeah.
constantly unfolding. And so when we're thinking about that process, we can envisage it as these distinct moments.
So does Ramakanta criticise him for that? Because he wants to maintain that there's a causation, presumably, between these moments,
yeah.
but also that each moment is discrete, and that's a real problem.
Yeah, I think that is somewhere where Buddhism it does lay itself open to attack.
Mm.
Was there a further Buddhist response then to Ramakanta?
No, not really,
round?
No. He didn't really succeed in eliciting a tradition of response from the Buddhist side. And Ramakanta was pretty much the last of the Kashmiri Shaiva Siddhanta commentators, so there's no sort of lineage of people who carried on this tradition going.
Ramakanta's position was you've got external objects and...
to that in a second. The second argument where this picture can be attacked, which is made by Udyotakara, is on this question of how can memory traces be passed, in inverted commas.
Mm-hmm.
And the Buddhist says, well, it's a relation of this is the samskaraka, and this is the samskarya.
Mm-hmm.
So this, the previous moment is... the example is of a piece of cloth which you pour some musk onto, so that the cloth gets scented by the musk. It's some samskaria in that sense of it's modified, influenced.
Yeah.
It takes on the smell of the musk.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the Buddhist model here, that somehow this one influences the next one, causing the next one to take on, not in this case the smell of the previous one, but the memory traces. And Udyotakara's argument is, well, how, if this moment never exists at the same time as this moment, there's no time in which they both exist, so how can one influence the other?
But that's, I won't go into it too much. I think, this idea of perfuming from moment to moment, I think that's right, although the Buddhists then go on to say, well, when we think of objects that do or don't exist at the same time and do or don't interact with each other physically, then we've got the wrong model in our heads. If we think of something more to do with structures, structural relations that move from moment to moment, let's say a bunch of billiard balls roll across the table, the three here and three here, and they hit some more billiard balls and they stop, and they cause those billiard balls to move across the table again. The three here and three here is very hard to make sense of, but you then get something which looks like the same thing carrying on, and two sets.
Where are these three?
Exactly.
Sure.
waves are a good one that's often used. And you still have it. This is the causality problem. What am I doing? We have a field. We have three objects. Let's say a bit like that. These are balls. And whoever our character is sent them flying across the table, and they move along. And what we focus on here is not that they're objects, but that we have this little structure, this little pattern of two and three. And they go along, and they go along, and they go along. And at some point, they hit. What can I say? A bunch. There's another line of billiard balls here. There's a moment where they interact, which is causal. I mean, we have to think of it not as physical objects banging each other, but there's a causal moment by which they cause certain of these billiard balls to start moving. And what you then get is another configuration of billiard balls, which are not the same ones, but actually, if you're not careful, you'll think that they are the same ones. If you've missed this causal moment in between.
That's the Buddhist model, then, isn't it?
That's kind of the Buddhist model. So there's a causal interaction, but it's not supposed to be seen as objects doing something to each other, but what you then get is something that looks very similar but isn't quite the same in a sense. But it's okay, because what we think of as the memory, and this is what's weird, is to think of the configuration. The person is not the billiard balls, the person is the configuration. The memory is the configuration. So what we get still has this configuration, which is identity or memory or what have you. You know, this is what makes the, this is the circle, if you like, is the shape that continues when we think of the firebrand circling through the air, even though the object itself is quite different. That's kind of a weird way to put it. But anyway, that's kind of an idea they use, I think, sometimes. And similarly with waves, when a wave moves across the water, it's different atoms, it's different molecules of water. It's just a kind of a physical causality that's caused them to move. But again, we see it as it were, if it were a single entity that moves across.
I see that, yeah. Nice analogy.
Mm.
So
I'll
approach
all of which to me raises the question what Buddhists are saying about the nature of time, because there's this incredible emphasis on momentariness and some kind of sequentiality, which suggests a kind of continuity, which again to me suggests a kind of unity, which they want to say is not there.
Mm.
There's a momentariness which is in the series, but wait a minute, what is that series? What is that sequence? What is that about? And then all of this makes me wonder that, in a sense, the idea of the Buddhist argument is philosophical simplicity, elegance of simple argument.
Mm.
And yet it seems in order to win one simplicity, it calls in a new complexity, you know, this moment, you know, what is happening with the samskara and samskaraka and samskarya, and what almost sounded like you saying suddenly we have multiple perceivers, you know, instead of no perceiver, it sounded like for a moment we had at every moment a new perceiver. Well, what happened to the simplicity? And in a way, I think that's what appeals about Ramakanta. He is pursuing a kind of philosophical elegance.
Mm. He's an interesting mix of Buddhism and Brahmanical thinking.
Well, that's one last point before we probably have to fold up soon. Ramakanta's world, you've got objects external to consciousness, and you've got the perceiver, and the objects cause, in some sense, the perception, the perception of them. So consciousness takes on the form of its objects in some sense, although you still have a perceiver there.
I wouldn't say Ramakanta consciousness takes on the form of its objects.
Right.
It illuminates the objects, like a light illuminating an object.
So it doesn't take on the form, right?
No, because light doesn't take on the form of its objects.
Right.
Light's not sort of moulded in any way by its objects.
Consciousness is always intentional for Ramakanta, in the sense that it always has an object in perception.
I don't think it does always have to have an object, actually, no. I mean, deep sleep would maybe be one
and consciousness could be self-aware, could be aware of itself in deep sleep. So what's I didn't quite perceive the difference in between Ramakanta's model and the Nyayikas then.
Well, for the Nyayikas, they accept each of these three things as distinct. So Nyayikas accept jnana, consciousness. Their model of jnana is similar to the Buddhists in that consciousness for the Nyayikas is moment consists of these discrete moments, but those discrete moments of consciousness belong to a separate self, a separate perceiver.
So
for Nyaya you have three ontological levels. For Ramakanta you only have two.
Right. But the perceiver is still nevertheless distinct from its object.
For both Ramakanta and Nyaya, perceiver is distinct from its object.
Clear up my head. For Ramakanta, is consciousness distinct from its contents? Because if the contents
Absolutely, yeah. It's distinct from its context. It's a kind of Samkhya view of consciousness being this pure thing which is like a mirror, you know, it's objects pass in front of it, but it itself never changes its nature, or like a light shining forth. Yeah. Whereas consciousness for the Buddhist is like a kind of putty or plasticine which moulds itself into the shape of whatever object.
Consciousness without a content is a very difficult concept.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, it's an idea from Samkhya and Vedanta that consciousness is compared to the sky. It's this huge, blank, empty thing in which nothing is happening, and clouds pass across it. And these clouds might be pleasure or pain or perceived objects, but the sky is completely unaffected by them. So in Vedantic meditation or Samkhya meditation, you try and identify with the sky as opposed to the clouds. Most of the time we're always identifying with the clouds. But you have to realise that actually these clouds are, that's not what I am. I'm not my thoughts, I'm not my perceptions, I'm not my sensations, I'm something further back than that, that's passively lying on a sofa watching it all happening, but somehow confusing myself with it and thinking that I am the thing which is acting.
This sounds so much like the Atman sort of idea, that it would sound like the self in Nyaya. It's quite confusing in a way. It's interesting, the light.
Well, that sounds like the Nyaya self.
Yeah, or at least it sounds like, the idea that, okay, it's not perceiver that matters, it's the consciousness. But actually, this is consciousness separate of its contents and separate of the objects which are over here on the fourth.
This is whose view?
Well, I guess this is. That's the Nyaya view, that you have a perceiver that's separate of the moments of consciousness.
Yeah.
But then Ramakanta comes and says, well, I also have something separate from moments of consciousness. I'm going to call it
consciousness.
Please, they can go.
Yeah, well, for Ramakanta, there are certain things which Ramakanta does admit are changing and are distinct, which you might think were consciousness, like thoughts.
Yeah.
But for Ramakanta, thoughts, just like pleasure and pain, are actually objects of consciousness, not consciousness itself. They're not the perceiver. It's much clearer in the Sanskrit.
Well, thanks, Alex. I think we must draw things to a close. Thanks very much for coming over.
Not at all,
no, enjoy it. It's really deeply, very deeply interesting topic. Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
And thanks for coming as well.
Especially this after lunch slot, which is the most the most tired time of day.
That was curious. Someone talks about blue, which is in your Skype already, and blue consciousness.
Yeah.
And he says they're the same, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, chapter 3 of my book's all about that.
Oh, right.
Yes, he does. That's one of Dharmakirti's arguments when he's talking from a Yogacara perspective.
Right. But he must assume the distinction between them in order to maintain that they're the same.
Well, yes, that's a whole debate within Buddhism.
Right.
Dharmakirti puts forward this argument that blue is not different from consciousness of blue or cognition of blue, but then later commentators they divide themselves into two camps. Are they completely non-different, or are they just only to some extent non-different?
It's very much, I was talking to an analytic philosopher recently, and there's such a movement to deny the existence of substances and say that there are only qualities and that it's exactly, and then if you add phenomenology onto it, then you go, it's just experiences of qualities, and that's all there are. And sometimes they seem to be part of a selfness or part of a blueberryness or whatever it is, but you know, people keep coming back to this argument. Partly because exactly what you say, it's so hard to imagine a pure consciousness without intentionality. And I think that whenever they talk about it, they don't really mean that at all.
Well, how can consciousness have itself as its own object without the content?
Yes, well, both Ramakanta and Buddhism think that it can, but lots of people in ancient India vigorously denied that.
Right.
Nayayikas and Vaisheshikas didn't think that consciousness could be self-reflexive. but Buddhism
in
and
a pure sense, anyway, being reflexive through its objects, being aware of itself through its objects.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. You mean consciousness could take itself as its own object?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it can. I don't understand. Without a content other than itself, I can't see how that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, the Nayayikas, yes, thought that, as I said, they conceived of consciousness as momentary.
Yeah.
And they denied that any one of these moments of consciousness could experience itself.
Right.
But they did think that this one could experience
could
the
reflect
previous one.
Yeah.
Through something called anuvyavasaya, sort of after determining this kind of cognition called anuvyavasaya, you could actually perceive the moment of consciousness before.
Yeah.
But for Buddhism and Ramakanta, no, they claim that in each moment of consciousness, consciousness perceives not only its objects but also itself.
Yeah.
And the analogy they used again was of a lamp. A lamp illuminates not only the objects around itself but also itself. A flame makes not only the objects around it visible, but it makes itself visible as well.
Right. Makes itself visible.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of the flame of a candle, that's
self-illuminating.
It's its own illumination.
Do they use that svaprakashika or something?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the terminology. Yeah,
right.
Swayam prakasha.
Right.
Swayam prakashika. Svaprakashika.
Sometimes you get philosophers who want to say, well, when I talk about perceiving my own consciousness, what I really mean is realizing the bare fact that I am consciousness. I am conscious. Or the bare fact of the fact that it being conscious, of consciousness being there, independent of the particular forms it takes, so that it's a kind of analytic realization, if you like, that the fact of consciousness being there is something different from the form, you know, the existence rather than the essence, and that to realize that is to have some kind of great understanding of things, because that at least is permanent. The fact that there's some consciousness there at least is unchanging and permanent, and it kind of offers a certain kind of stability.
Oh, we've gone to a halt.
Are you teaching in London?
No. At the moment.
Researching and writing instead.
Sorry?
Researching and writing instead.
Yeah, occasionally.
It's the Holy Grail, it's to be not doing things
I'd like to turn this into an article explanation.
Articles out of the thesis, right?
Yeah, well, I think this might be the last article about that overlaps with my thesis.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got other articles I want to write.
Mm-hmm.
Would I believe you should go to me doing a graduate seminar?
How much do we know about the history of Shaiva Siddhanta moving a story of
graduate students
Brahmin migration?
I don't know about that. I think that might be the wrong way of looking at it. I think maybe in the early period it was sort of fairly well disseminated throughout India, and then it was a question of dying out everywhere except in Tamil Nadu. Shaiva Siddhanta died out in Kashmir, leaving
just
non-dualistic
like
Shaivism in Kashmir. South India. But no, there was some movement from Kashmir, Kashmiri Shaivist Siddhanta tradition spreading south, because Agora Shiva was from South India and he was very much a follower of Ramakanta.
Hmm.
issue, perhaps, or
so salvation will mean getting rid of all that rubbishy stuff and getting back to the procedure, and then
becoming omniscient and omnipotent.
But not merging with other selves.
No merging.
Cool. That's what everybody wants. Like,
getting sort
stuff.
Of the best
of both. Exactly.
So no, that's quite unusual. I mean, most people envisage moksha as sort of devoid of any objects of consciousness. But for Ramakanta, no,
so
yes, in liberation you come to know all objects.
That's interesting. Or else you get what you were saying about other theist schools where they keep their self, but they definitely don't become omniscient. They just kind of look at God a lot in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, which is better than being omniscient?
That was really great, Alex. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
You don't want to go study your philosophy.
Excellent.
That's just what I'm writing about now, is whether you can, all the philosophers have tried to figure out whether you can have pure consciousness
right.
of yourself in the different ways they've tried to argue for it.
It's also, I mean, presumably this is outside of the time. Yeah. This is not a temporal dilemma.
I'm not entirely sure.
But
don't
know. I mean, the Vedantic self maybe is, but this thing is, I mean, it's eternal.
It's not
delimited by time. It's not limited by time. But I think that just means it lasts forever.
And this is his body then, this is in a sense, this entire body, this relationship.
Yes.
So it's always his body.
Well, actually no. In India the line comes down here between body and consciousness. It's all goes complete dualism for both Buddhism and the Brahmanic discipline between mind and body.
So this is just
once you get down to Ankara and Buddhi and Manas, then you're in the physical world.
And then what's your liberating? That relationship is broken and you're just left
now.
By yourself.
For Sankhya,
but not
for Ramakanta, you become omniscient. So you do actually carry on experiencing objects. So quite unusual, and he attacks these people who claim that moksha is just an